Morning. Almost everyone is here. Practically nobody dropped out for a holiday or anything. This is commendable. Yeah, you know, the notes are getting way out of hand here because I forgot to give you the orange one I intended for last week. The notes you get today with the funny diagram at the top, those are actually ahead of where we're really at. As far as where we're at in the text, that's several weeks back. So I guess I'm encouraging you to read ahead here a little bit. I go home generally on Sunday afternoon and I think ahead and write it all down and forget where we stopped. Mostly, the notes are mostly copied from Ray, so they're not, it's just by, in case you haven't gotten Ray's book on Hebrews. Today we're actually at chapter 7, I think. The book of Hebrews is about a journey, about dynamic salvation. It's about an ongoing relationship of Jesus Christ that starts at a certain point in time and takes us day by day throughout our lives with a goal in mind. This is the big theme that runs through this whole book. We are led in this journey by one who is called the author and finisher of our faith, or the pioneer of our salvation, the Lord Jesus Christ, who is particularly well qualified to lead a pilgrimage, to lead a people on a journey out of the world. This is the Son of God who became a man in order to solve the human problem of sin and evil, by identifying with us, by resolving the alienation of mankind from God. So our leader is a human being who's exceptionally well qualified to be the trailblazer for us. The journey that we're on is a perilous journey, so the author of Hebrews gives us five warnings throughout this book, the things that we want to watch out for, the dangers along this journey, because it's a perilous journey. And last week we had the great warning in chapter 6 about the dangers of not pressing on to maturity, the dangers of getting stuck and not growing up and staying in the early infancy stages of spiritual growth and not moving on to maturity. So that was the third great warning. The author has also introduced a whole new theme, and that is that the leader of our journey is also our priest, a great high priest. And that's a theme that actually got introduced in chapter 2. It came up again in chapter 5. The writer here interrupted that to give us this big warning, and then he's going to pick this theme up again, that Jesus is our priest. And I have mentioned to you that in our culture, we don't really know what a priest is. Ray always said the priests were like psychiatrists and psychologists. They're like counselors. That's probably closer to what a biblical priest is. The Roman Catholic priesthood is not at all close to what the biblical priesthood is. It's a big distortion of the biblical priesthood, because in the New Testament, all of us are a kingdom of priests, and we all serve directly the great high priest Jesus, and we're all priests one to another, and so we're a fellowship of priests. And so I've urged you to rethink the idea that Jesus is your priest, that Jesus is somebody you can come to with all of your troubles and cares and problems, and you'll find that he identifies with you, that he's ready to take your case to the Father as your advocate, as your intercessor, that he's praying constantly for you, that he longs to have an intimate relationship with you, that he's more than ready to deal with all of our failures and shortcomings, and also with the outworking of our sins. He's wants to help, but he also is an encourager and a strengthener and a comforter. And our priest does that for us. And so the importance of Hebrews, one of the big themes in here is the importance of coming to know your great high priest. And of course, the better you know him, the better a priest you will be to your fellow travelers, and the better you can relate to people in the world. Nothing speaks more powerfully than your actual experience with God. If you have real experience with God, then you're very credible, even if your vocabulary stumbles a little bit. So this is an important thing, and I would hope during this class that you'd rethink the role that Jesus has as being the priest that you go to constantly, and who's on your side and who's alongside of you to make sure that you finish this great journey. Last week, at the end of chapter 5, the writer brought in Abraham and God's promises to Abraham, which came late in Abraham's life. And that is going to introduce another theme that comes up more strongly later in Hebrews, and that's the theme of faith. We are on this pilgrimage journey by faith. We're trusting in what God has said to be true. We're relying on His promises. That's how we make this journey, and that's going to come up later. But now in chapter 7, we get back to the lengthy description of who Jesus is as our great high priest. Chapter 7, verse 1, this Melchizedek, just in the previous verse, this hope we have as an anchor for the soul, both sure and steadfast, which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, Jesus, having become a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. The idea here is that there is an anchor for your hope in the Holy of Holies of the temple in heaven. You can put your hopes there in that holy place, which was inaccessible to the ordinary people in the Old Testament, but it's now wide open to us. Jesus has gone into the Holy of Holies in the heavenly temple. That's where we put our hopes. He's the forerunner, and He's gone there to open the door for us and to pave the way for us to come into the intimate presence of God. And if you think back to the Old Testament Holy of Holies and how frightening it would be for sinful human beings to deal with a holy God, and how the only intermediary was the high priest of the Levites, who could only go into the Holy of Holies once a year, and with fear and trembling, taking blood for his own sins and the sins of the people, and he might be rejected. And at no other time during the whole year could anyone go into the Holy of Holies. And so that made God somewhat remote and awesome and frightening, particularly if there was nothing no one in the middle to solve the problem of human sin. And now, of course, Jesus has solved all the problem of human sin as the mediator, and so the veil of the Holy of Holies is opened, and you're invited right into God's presence. So that contrast comes up repeatedly in this book. Jesus is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. This Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. The name Melchizedek has got two Hebrew words in it: Melchi, king; Zedek, righteous. So his name essentially means king of righteousness. He's also called the king of Salem. Salem is an ancient name for Jerusalem. This would have been 4,000 years ago. This is 1,000 years before King David conquered this Jebusite town of Salem and made it his capital city. So 1,000 years before King David, before there ever was a legitimate Jerusalem, there was a righteous king in this Canaanite town of Salem. And apparently a Gentile, we don't know anything about him, except that he's a very honorable man, and he is a priest somehow of God Most High. He combines, this man Melchizedek, combines the office of king and priest in one office. And he's the priest of God Most High, so he's the priest of the one true God, and we don't know anything about him. We don't know anything about where he came from, except that he's very, very important. Now, under the Old Covenant, under the history of Israel, we have separate kings and priests. There's two separate branches of the theocracy of Israel. When Jesus returns, we get those offices put back together again, like Melchizedek. We get king and priest in one office. Jesus is king and priest. And Melchizedek was king and priest, but in the intermediate period, the Levitical priests were separate from the kings of Israel. So that's interesting. Now we get this little historical look back at Genesis chapter 14. Abraham met Melchizedek, and the incident that's described here is in Genesis chapter 14. You remember that when Abraham and his nephew and all of his family came from what is now Iraq to the Holy Land, they were promised that whatever amount of land they'd like to walk on and take and possess, and they brought sheep and animals with them, and their flocks grew and multiplied, and Abraham and Lot lived together for a while until their flocks got so large that it was important they split up. And Abraham gave Lot the first choice of where you'd like to move to, and Lot looked over into the southern end of the Dead Sea and saw that it was then lush and green, and he picked that part of the country to go live in, and Abraham let him go live there, and he happened to go live in one of the five cities of the Canaanites that include Sodom and Gomorrah. And he looked at the externals of what he thought would be prosperity and blessing, and he hoped that he could become an important person in the city of Sodom, and we all know that that didn't work out very well. He made his home there and settled there. Now, and Lot was a righteous man. We find that out in the New Testament that he actually was upset and disturbed in his spirit by the immoral behavior of the people there, but he had very negligible influence on them. Now, some years later, a bunch of bad guys, a bunch of marauding kings from the east, maybe as far away as Pakistan or Persia, come raiding into the territory, raiding into Jordan, and they happen to be raiding down in the Dead Sea Valley, just plundering and pillaging as the ancient kings like to do, and they happen to raid Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain down there, and they captured the inhabitants and took them away. Well, Abraham finds out about this, but Abraham has no vested interest in the welfare of Sodom and Gomorrah and the well-being of the people there. It's out of his territory, except for his nephew Lot, who lives there with family. And so because of that, Abraham rounds up 318 of his own loyal men and hires some conscripts and goes chasing after these bad kings, chases them all the way up to Damascus and captures them and recovers all the goods and Lot and all the people kidnapped from Sodom and Gomorrah and takes them back. Lot could have, of course, said, "Thank you, Abraham. I'd like to come and live with you again," but he didn't do that. He said, "I want to go back to my hometown of Sodom and hang out there," which, of course, is a long-term disaster for him. So Abraham, just by God's grace, runs down and restores Lot and restores the cities of the plain, puts them back. And as he's returning with the captives, he stops by Jerusalem, and there's Melchizedek. And Melchizedek comes out to Abraham and blesses him and offers him bread and wine. If you want to attach significance to that, you can. But it's very obvious that Melchizedek's a very important man. Not only that, but some of the spoil that was captured is tithed to Melchizedek in respect of his priesthood. And Abraham shows homage and respect to Melchizedek. So obviously the point here is that Melchizedek is a very, very important person. Up until now, Abraham's the hero of our faith. And now we find out there's somebody greater that has a special relationship with God, and that's this strange man, Melchizedek, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all of the plunder from Sodom and Gomorrah after it was regained. First, Melchizedek's name means king of righteousness, and then king of Salem, that is king of peace. Salem, Shalom, Jerusalem, city of peace. Melchizedek has no known father. There's no known mother. We don't have any record whatsoever of who his parents were, forefathers were. His no genealogy. We don't know if he had brothers or sisters or a wife or family or any descendants after him. He just appears on the stage of history and has this little brief mention in Genesis and disappears all the way until we get to Psalm 110 and then the book of Hebrews again. He has neither beginning of days nor end of life. We don't know how long he served in this role in Jerusalem or anything else about him. Made like the Son of God, he remains a priest continually. So he has this office of being king and priest in Jerusalem. Now, some people would like to make Melchizedek some mystical figure like Michael the Archangel, or maybe Jesus himself, or maybe Shem. Shem lived 500 years after the flood. I don't think there's anything supernatural about this man. I think he was just a very godly man whom God had chosen. There's one thing that's interesting, that Abraham and his father, Terah, before they left Ur of the Chaldees, were not godly people. They were caught up in the local idolatry of the time. And Abraham's in the line of Shem. That's the line that God had promised would be the line leading to the Messiah. So Abraham comes into the Promised Land pretty well ignorant of the history that has gone on before. He doesn't know all about the promises that God had made to the patriarchs. So maybe Melchizedek sat him down and told him this whole history and gave him this whole record. Abraham's got to pass this history on down to his family afterwards, and eventually it's going to get to Moses, and Moses has to write it down in the first five books of the Old Testament. So maybe Melchizedek is this scholar with a knowledge of all the history, and maybe he's in the role of a mentor for Abraham. At least he's certainly the godly man that is honored. This also is kind of interesting because there's a lot of chosen people in the world that are apparently not in the scriptures. God's working out in all the nations of the world. Here we get the mention of somebody named Melchizedek. We don't know anything about him. And that would suggest right away that there, down through history of the world, there's been gods had been working in people's lives, and it just isn't written in the Bible, so we haven't met them yet. Maybe we get to heaven, we'll meet some very interesting people, and we'll be surprised at God's grace out among the nations of the world. Because the Bible is giving us more or less the mainstream that leads to the Messiah, and it's giving the main line. It doesn't mean there aren't branches going off, okay? Consider how great this man Melchizedek was. Abraham, the patriarch, gave him a tenth of the spoils. And indeed, those who are the sons of Levi, who receive the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law, that is, from their brothers, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here, mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak. He was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Now, that's kind of complicated there. Abraham will have a son named Isaac. Isaac will have sons named Jacob and Esau. Jacob will have his name changed to Israel. Israel will be the patriarch of the 12 tribes of Israel, one of whom is Levi. That is, there aren't any Jews around at this time. There aren't any 12 tribes. There aren't any Levitical priests at the time that Abraham goes to Melchizedek. But Abraham's clearly the forefather of, he's the father of Isaac and the grandfather of Jacob and the great-great-grandfather of Levi. So if Abraham is presenting tithes to this priest Melchizedek, then in a sense, all of his descendants are too. Isaac and Jacob and Levi are all, in a sense, tithing through Abraham. They're not born yet. They're in the loins of Abraham. That is, they're the seed of Abraham. Now, that's a kind of an Old Testament way of looking at things. you're in the loins of your father before you were ever even born. That's kind of an ancient Eastern way of looking at it. But do you see the point here? Levi cannot later claim to have a superior priesthood. That's the whole point. Because when Abraham and Melchizedek had this meeting, there weren't any Levitical priests, there wasn't any Levi, and there wasn't any Isaac, and there wasn't any Jacob. There was only Abraham, the forefather of all these. So this makes Melchizedek stand out as a very, very important type. Okay? That's what this is rambling on about. Therefore, now he goes on, if perfection had been obtainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there be that the priest should arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not according to the order of Aaron? In your notes today, I put a little analysis of what the word perfection means in Greek, that it really has to do with maturity, with growing up, with wholeness, with completeness, rather than flawlessness. If the Levitical priesthood were able to make you a whole person, if it were able to solve all of your problems, then it would still be in force. You wouldn't replace it with something else. There's something about the Levitical priesthood that made it temporary in nature, and it wasn't able to bring people to the wholeness and the healing that God intended for us. Okay? You wouldn't need to replace it if it was functioning fine. You don't need to replace somebody who's the CEO of the company if the company's really doing well and everything's running fine. There's no need to make any changes. Now, if you're going to change the priesthood, then you also have to make a change in the covenant or the law or the rules and regulations that go hand in hand with the priesthood. So if we're going to change the priesthood, we have to change the covenant. That's the argument here that comes along in verse 11. In 12, the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change in the law. And this gets a little interesting here. So we're going to get rid of the old Levitical priesthood because it wasn't able to get the job done as far as bringing people into maturity and wholeness. It didn't work very well. The priesthood is weak, as we've seen. And the whole nature of the priesthood didn't enable it to bring people to the goal that God intends for us. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the old covenant or that it's an unholy covenant or any such thing. It's not the point, as we'll see. priesthood being changed, of necessity there is a change of the law. He of whom these things are spoken, that's Jesus, belongs to another tribe from which no man has officiated at the altar. It is evident that our Lord arose from the tribe of Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning the priesthood. Now, the Levitical priests were hereditary. They were all the sons of Aaron and Levi. So it goes father to son to father to son. As soon as one priest dies, he's replaced. So it was all quite clear all the way through the Old Testament that all legitimate priests were in the family line of Levi, one branch or another of the tribe of Levi. Now, all of a sudden, we get this announcement that Jesus has been appointed as a high priest, but he comes from the tribe of Judah, and you can read all the way through the Old Testament, there's not a word said about priests in connection with the tribe of Judah. So it's a big surprise, in other words. What in the world are we doing with a priest who's from the tribe of Judah? That's unheard of. It doesn't fit anything that Moses wrote about. It's going to be a brand new priesthood. And yet, verse 15, it is far more evident if, in the likeness of Melchizedek, there arises another priest who has come, not according to the law of fleshly commandments, but according to the power of an endless life. Right away, this new priest that comes along is going to be far different from the Levitical priest. This priest is going to live forever, so you only need one of them. You don't need father, son, every time one of the priests dies. You've got, this priest's going to live forever, so we only have to have one. And that's already unique. And not only that, but he's a priest independent of the law. Priest that is not ministering by the law of Moses at all, but by the power of an endless life. And then once again, the writer quotes Psalm 110, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." Now, Psalm 110, written by David, clearly is a messianic prediction. Jesus is a priest like Melchizedek was, king and priest. He's like that. And the whole idea also here is that as long as the Levitical priesthood is functioning, the new high priest can't take his office. You have to finish with the Levitical priesthood. Jesus assumes his office as a great high priest, and from the point that Jesus becomes a great high priest, you no longer need the old priesthood anymore, and it's null and void and obsolete. That's going to come up in here. The other thing that I kind of jolted me about in Ray Sedman's notes this last week was that Ray points out that in a sense all of us start life as under the old covenant. We all start life under some kind of performance code of ethics. You know, try harder. If I just do a reasonably good job, God will accept me. Oh, I think my good deeds will outweigh my bad deeds. I just am doing the best I possibly can. Surely that's acceptable to God. Performance oriented. That's old covenant. Even all kinds of people live under that sort of presupposition that life is an old covenant relationship with God, that it's based on performance. Do the best you can, try harder, improve yourself. That's good enough. That isn't good enough. So we all started under an old covenant. We lapse into an old covenant every time we lapse into performance-oriented, every time we forget about resting, every time we start to do something in our own strength. Again, we've lapsed under the old covenant. So this is kind of default mode for the human race is an old covenant way of looking at things, hoping that your good deeds and your performance will be acceptable to God. And of course, the holier you see God, the harder you'll try or squirm out or do something to hope that you'll have God's good favor under a weight of guilt. And of course, the law wasn't there to do that. The purpose of the law wasn't to get you to try harder. The purpose of the law was to show you how hopeless your situation was and how desperately lost you were so that you cry out to God for mercy. And the moment you cry out to God for mercy, he shows up and you essentially have a new covenant relationship with God right then and there, even if you lived a long time ago. So we really have much more of an old covenant residue around us, even when we're new covenant Christians. So I think that means that we're not talking just about some ancient history about Israel. We're talking about the whole human race. The new covenant is what we are to live under right now, and it's new and powerful and effective and liberating, and it's entirely different from the old covenant. I think William Barclay, in his commentary, points out how people build churches that at least medieval churches, always looked like the tabernacle. They always had a holy sanctuary up front that nobody could go into, and special rooms for the choirs, and it was all the congregation come in the back door of the cathedral, and everything up front is holy and holier and inaccessible, and all that's just kind of old covenant. All of that makes God formidable and makes him far off and makes him unapproachable, and it puts barriers. And then, of course, in the Catholic Church, where you have an official priesthood, there's no way to get to God except going through one of those officially appointed priests. We have to be careful in the Protestant churches not to do that, not to make our ministers, our staff members, not to look at them as if they are the intermediaries in my relationship with God. Because there is no human being who stands between me and God. My intermediary is Jesus, priesthood of all believers again. Well, it's kind of interesting if you stop and think about how much of the old covenant way of thinking we carry over with into our lives today. Okay? End of sermonette, homily. I'll quit my homily. Verse 18. On the one hand, there is an annulling of the former commandment. Annulment. Annulment of the old covenant. This is pretty heavy-duty stuff here. You know, the Jews in Jerusalem who want to build a third temple are trying to put together a third temple which operates on the old covenant. They're going to put animal sacrifices. They're training the priests. They don't know that that's all null and void. The Jews don't recognize that it's null and void, that it's obsolete, doesn't have any validity as far as God's concerned. In ignorance, that's what we do. That's how we go back. The religions of the world think that they can get to God by some kind of a system that's man-made. Well, here it is very clear. It's null and void. On the one hand, there is the annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness. Imagine that, calling the old covenant weak and unprofitable. The law made nothing perfect. No, exactly right. The law only just reveals sin. That's all it does. It just shows you your need for sin and for mercy from God. And it shows you what God's like. The law made nothing perfect. On the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. We have something better. Inasmuch as he was not made priest without an oath, Jesus was not put into the office of great high priest without an oath, they have become priests without an oath. The Levitical priests didn't have to take any special oath when they came into office. But he, with an oath, by him, an oath from God, who said to Jesus, "The Lord has sworn and will not relent, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So there's an oath from God which appoints Jesus to be our great high priest and which lets him take up his ministry as our great high priest. So much more, all the more, Jesus has become a guarantor, a surety of a better covenant. A guarantor is a person who guarantees a contract or guarantees that something will happen. It stands in the middle of a contract to make sure that it's all, that all parties are all satisfied. Jesus has the guarantor or the surety of a better covenant. And the first time we have the word covenant in the book of Hebrews, by the way, we're sneaking into this whole idea of covenants. And here's the very first time the word covenant is mentioned. Jesus has become the person who guarantees a better covenant. There were many priests who could not continue in their office because they died. And it'd be pretty awful to have a favorite priest, a favorite Levitical priest that knew you really well and knew your family and had been around and was somebody that you trusted and cared about. You knew their shortcomings and weakness, and no sooner did you get comfortable with them than they died. And then you had to go to some new Levitical priest. And that's kind of unsatisfactory. It's like having a favorite pastor or a favorite preacher on the radio, and then they die or they go away, and then they're not there anymore. You start all over again with a priest. Because what you want in a priest is somebody who's sympathetic and understanding and cares and is a champion of your cause and knows your weaknesses, obviously. Isn't that what you want in a priest? The Levitical priest never could do that because they just died. But he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Now, this is, it gets pretty awesome when you think about this. This is the creator of the universe we're talking about, the one who chose you from the foundation of the world, the one that was there when you were formed in your mother's womb, the one who was there long before you ever became a Christian, knows all the whole story of your life, the one who's on your side, who wants you to win, who likes you, cares about you, who died for you. This is your priest. This priest is an eternal, always living priest. He was there throughout all eternity past. He's going to be there for the future, and he's your advocate. Now, you see what a contrast that is. And this priest is sinless. He continues forever, and he has an unchangeable priesthood. He's always going to be there for you. He's always going to be the same. He is able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, and he always lives to make intercession for them. Last night, while you were sound asleep, Jesus was making intercession for you. He was going over your life with the Father and praying for you and bringing your case into the Father's presence as your intercessor, as your advocate, as the one who prays for you. That's kind of nice to have a 24-hour priest, and you don't even have to call him on the phone. If he sees you have needs and problems, he's going to go to prayer for you. If you have a rough spot, you have some bad things coming up next Friday, he's going to anticipate that. That's pretty neat. And you don't have to make him aware of your problems like you would a counselor or a Levitical priest. He already knows about them. It would be nice if you talked to him about them so that he appreciated that you were interested in him and his endless work. And you don't get a big bill at the end of the month from this guy, by the way. Such a high priest, Jesus, such a high priest was fitting for us. This is just absolutely the most wonderful news in the world, to have a priest like this. He is holy. He is harmless or innocent. He's undefiled. He's separated from sinners, and he is higher than the heavens. If you go to a good friend and confide in your good friend, you're always going to realize at some point your friend is not going to understand you or identify with you or get exactly what you mean. And your friend is going to have impediments because they're sinful. They're going to have obstacles or barriers where they don't hear you or they don't identify with you or they can't be there for you. That's why we all have to have many friends sometimes. Share a little here and a little there with people that we can confide in. And our friends are all working on their problems too. Well, not when you go to Jesus. He's innocent of all sin. He's holy. He's undefiled. He's separate from sinners. He's not all caught up in the things of the world that distract your friends and your spouse and others around you. No, he's got his time set aside for you. That's, you know, office hours 24/7. So you can go to him all the time. He does not need daily, as the high priests of Levi have to do, to offer up sacrifices. He's not busy running into the tabernacle or into the temple in Jerusalem offering animal sacrifices all the time. First of all, for his own sins so that he can be qualified to help you, and then busy offering sacrifices for everybody else. So, you know, most of his day is spent offering sacrifices. That's not Jesus. He does not need daily, as the Levitical high priests do, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the people's. This he did once for all when he offered up himself. The problem of sin was historically solved 2,000 years ago in 6 hours of earth time by Jesus, who solved the whole problem of human sin all at once in his body, and so that issue's closed. So that's not what he's mainly concerned with today. He's not so much concerned with sin as with your salvation, with your wholeness, with your moving on this journey. Okay? The law appoints as high priests men who have weaknesses, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints the Son who has been perfected forever. The fact that Jesus has been perfected forever, and we talked about that in connection with the Garden of Eden, that he's been through the whole gamut of human experience, suffering and temptation and testing and trial and hurt and pain, that he is fully mature. So when you talk to Jesus, you're talking to somebody who's thoroughly experienced and qualified from his humanity to identify with you. So you're not talking to somebody who's also on the journey of becoming whole. You're talking to somebody who understands the beginning of the journey and the end of it as well. He has been perfected forever, and his ministry is apart from the law. The main point of what we're saying is this. We have such a high priest. who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. Now, this also, the seated at the right hand of the majesty, is, it isn't like God's man sitting on a chair up in the sky. One of the things that when you read through this book of Hebrews, one of the things you tend to do is to put God way up in the clouds someplace. And there's a whole other theme in, that we have to think about in Hebrews. That's why that diagram is on the notes today. Ultimately, in the final analysis, man is the temple of God. You are the temple of God. You are body, soul, and spirit. Your human spirit is the holy of holies. The work of Jesus is the conquest of inner space. It's making you a whole person from the inside. So Jesus, in a sense, sits on the throne with the Father in your heart in order to make you whole. That's how intimate and personal and down to earth this is. So we're not going to a God who's way up there someplace. We have to talk to at warp speed to get the message back and forth. But we're talking to an intimate, personal, interior God. That's another thing that I think will come out in this little study. Nancy Missler has a great book called Be Ye Transformed, which is an awful title for a book. And Nancy Missler has made a study of the temple and the symbolism of the temple in the Old Testament to show how the temple and the services of the temple are a beautiful picture of man. Of man as body, soul, and spirit, as man as conscious and unconscious, of how the will works, how we work as functioning temples. And that's a whole kind of an undiscovered, untouched issue for us. You are the temple of the living God. The church is the temple of the living God. So that this priesthood of Jesus is very much has to do with making us into whole persons, into whole temples, into complete buildings where God can live. So that's a little side note there. Jesus is a minister of the sanctuary and the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. The word minister here is the word from which we get liturgy. Jesus is the liturgist. He's the worship leader in the congregation. You remember when Doug Goins pointed that out to me, that in somebody leading the worship should think of Jesus as being the real worship leader. That comes up in Isaiah, and it comes up in other places in the Old Testament, that when we gather together for worship, Jesus is the one who is worshiping the Father by bringing us together with Him into the presence of the Father and thanking God for us and leading us in our worship. This verse 8:2. A minister of the sanctuary and the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not men. Now there's immediately, now we're taken from the tabernacle of Moses to a temple in heaven, which the tabernacle of Moses is copied. Remember when Moses went up on Mount Sinai, God said, I want you to make this tabernacle down there, and I want you to follow the blueprints very carefully, and I want you to make this exactly according to the blueprint. And the blueprint, there is a permanent temple in heaven, and this tabernacle is a copy. And the Levitical priests are going to serve in this copy, which is the shadow, which points to invisible things. Now, Jesus doesn't have anything to do with that shadow. He's gone into the temple in heaven, which is the original. You don't need the carbon copy when you've got the original. Ray illustrates this very nicely. Ray said, when I go on a trip, I take with me in my billfold a picture of my wife and my daughters. But I don't confuse for one moment the picture with the reality. I use the picture to remind me of my wife and daughters so that when I get back home, I can enjoy the reality of them again. That's the analogy here between the shadow of something that points to something and the reality it points to. You don't want a photograph of your loved ones when you can have your loved ones, obviously. But the shadow, the photograph, is valuable. It's a good reminder. Okay. Every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. That's part of what any priest does. Therefore, it is necessary that this high priest has something to offer. You're going to put Jesus in as a high priest. He has to have something to offer. If he were on earth, if he were a Levitical priest, he would not be a priest. He couldn't be a priest. Since there are priests who offer according to the law, who serve the copy of the shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For Moses said, God said to Moses, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. If Jesus were a high priest here on earth now, he would compete with Levi. Then you'd have two competing priesthoods, and think what a mess that would be. So you can't have these two priesthood functioning, and you particularly can't have them on earth, and you can't have two tabernacles, and so on. You've got to have one or the other. And it's quite clear that the Levitical priests serve in the shadow, in the earthly tabernacle, but Jesus in the true. Jesus has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. We get a new high priest in office now, we'll set up a whole new system, a whole new administration, a whole new covenant. So, new priest, new covenant. We'll talk more about that as we get into this book. Now he has obtained a more excellent ministry as our priest. And the priesthood comes first, and then the covenant. Your relationship with God comes first, then the covenant. Then we'll see what the terms and conditions are. If that first covenant had been faultless, there would be no place for a second. There would be no reason to replace it. Finding fault with them, God says, and this is now quotes Jeremiah 31:31, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the hand of Egypt, because they did not continue in my covenant, and so I disregarded them, says the Lord. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I'll put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. None of them will teach his neighbor and none his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me from the least of them to the greatest. I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more." In that, he says, God says, a new covenant, he has made the first covenant, the old covenant, obsolete. That which is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Now, what the writer does is he goes back to Jeremiah and he lifts out this very extensive quote, and we'll go into this more later, because the other major prophets also announce a new covenant. God will one day make a new covenant with Israel. Nothing said about the church here at this point in time. New covenant with Israel, and the new covenant's promised to Israel, and it's going to work totally different, and the reason for this new covenant is the old covenant isn't working very well, and the reason the old covenant isn't working very well is people aren't obeying it. And the track record of Israel under the old covenant is so bad, God says, I disregarded them. If only these stubborn, stiff-necked people would pay attention to what I've told them and all the provisions I've made for them, we'd be doing just fine. But hundreds of years have gone by, and these stubborn, rebellious people keep ignoring my love for them and my provision for them and this priesthood and all these things that I've wanted to show them. It isn't working. It isn't working because it was bad. It's not working. It's not working because people won't pay any attention to it. Of course, that's kind of scary. You know, you'd think that people would jump at the opportunity to know God, and that people would see right through the ceremony of the temple. They'd see right through to the reality, but it isn't so. Now, this isn't, God didn't disregard them in a summary way after a short time of disobedience. His patience with Israel goes on for century after century after century. It's only with great reluctance that God says, I guess I have to give up on you guys. I guess we're going to have to do some heavy-duty reorganizing here. There's always a remnant. There are always people that do pay attention to God and do listen and do catch the message. But the new covenant is announced in here because we need a new and better and more powerful arrangement, more personal arrangement. We need to cut right through to the core of things, and the new covenant will do that. Okay? Now, how did the new covenant get to us? That's another issue, because this isn't a covenant with us, it's with Israel. This new covenant is very different because it's going to work by changing people on the inside, not by measuring their external performance. It's going to change the heart. If you have thought at all about your relationship with Jesus and how it works and why it is you don't sin anymore, and it's because you don't want to sin anymore. It's because God's taken out of your heart a whole bunch of things that were faulty: lying, stealing, cheating, murdering, lusting, wasting time, all the things that were bad in your heart have been removed and quietly replaced, and suddenly you have a whole bunch of new interests, and naturally, when your heart's new, you want it to be new. So the new covenant's going to get the job done, because it's going to change you at the core of your being. It doesn't have anything to do with just your external performance. External performance can be about hypocrisy. It can be about being phony. It can be about pretending to be religious. It can be about trying to fool people. Well, the new covenant doesn't allow that. The new covenant is going to work at the heart. I ran quickly through two whole chapters. And obviously there's a lot here. There's a lot to think about in terms of our relationship with Jesus, moment by moment, day by day, as our great high priest. Our relationship with one another in community, as a priesthood. This radical contrast between Old Covenant and New Covenant. Nowhere in the New Testament is this contrast made as clear as it is in the book of Hebrews. You'll see the New Covenant in Romans, and you see it in 2 Corinthians, and it comes up in Galatians, but here it's crystal clear. And we'll continue with that next week. And it's powerful and it's effective. And it's a covenant with Israel, and now we'll see how we get invited into it later on. Okay?
Anybody know what time I'm talking about this thing called the paradigm shift? And I couldn't help but think that, you know, this is what this chapter is all about. I mean, I'm that year. It really needs to be mad.
Do you think your father may have perceived the heart of God more readily than some of us would? That he saw through the reality? The first time I ever went to Egypt, I was amazed at some of the godly Muslims that I met, who everybody called them true Muslims, because they were kind and gracious and at peace and seemed to understand more about God than I did, and I, in my self-righteousness, and In Egypt, there are also the bad Muslims that are noted to be hypocrites and phonies. But the good Muslims were always men that you paid attention to. You had to respect them. Hard to get around to the dialogue about what they believed, but it always made me wonder if they hadn't discovered the same reality that I had. God's got a great big heart for people, whether their vocabulary is right or not. To get the language down right. When we were back in chapter 4 in God's rest, there was this scripture in there about the word of God being swift and powerful and about things being open and laid bare before the eyes of him with whom we have to do, suggesting that we have to refine our walk with God as we are along this journey, that every day there will be some new learning. If we're dynamic Christians, we'll be learning and growing, and we'll see new areas in our lives that were in fact the flesh that we didn't recognize before. That it isn't that you necessarily arrive all in one instant to an awareness of this covenant. I think is that we're more likely to grow into it. When you see an area, I think when you're really good at something, you think, well, I can handle this better than God can, so you just run on your own self-effort and leave the autopilot on and breeze right through it, and it's all flesh. And those things you don't give them up easily. Reputation and career and you're in the community and all those meritorious things can also be flesh. But I think that the other thing that came out was that when you are really resting in Jesus comes this shalom, this peace. Shalom means the peace that comes from wholeness, from being at peace with God and your fellow men. It's this shalom is this all is well, because Jesus is handling things. God is holy, and therefore there's some things in my life that are so bad and so despicable that I don't dare bring them up to him because they're out of bounds, when in fact he knows all about them anyway. And that would be the priest is to help you to deal with those very issues in your life that are also sordid and rotten and corrupt and ugly, and the things you don't share with anybody can go to the priest. So that's all has to do with intimacy with God. The way you can have intimacy with a holy God. Our relationships with other people are never any better than our relationship with Jesus is. And that would be true in a marriage or in a friendship. If you deepen your relationship with God, your relationship with other people will automatically deepen as a consequence.